favorite chapter of the Bible. Before that, I did want to mention, too. And it's funny because when I pick my next favorite, then that week I love it even more than the other ones. So this is really arbitrary in some ways. I love so many chapters of the Bible. But before that, I wanted to mention the women's retreat that's coming up in October. And if you ladies haven't signed up for that yet, there's a table in the foyer, and they'll be there to answer any questions and to get you signed up. So I really encourage you to do that. I know I'm aware of some of the things they're going to talk about and the people who are going to speak, and it really is going to be a time you won't want to miss, ladies. Just a great opportunity to go out to the Palo Mesa Resort with some other women and just enjoy the Lord, enjoy the fellowship, and let God do what he wants to do in your life. So if you haven't signed up, maybe you haven't signed up because you're like, I don't know anybody or nobody I know is going. There's no better way to get to know people than to do that. And so there'll be people there that don't know anyone who somebody brings or whatever. Doesn't matter, because a retreat is a time to just step back and take a fresh look at our lives and see what God's going to do. So I would really encourage you to do that, and I know it'll be a blessing. So my third favorite chapter of the Bible, right now it's my first favorite, but that changes, is Hebrews chapter 11, and I cheated by going partway into chapter 12 as well. But this, I've loved this chapter. It's the chapter that's typically called the Hall of Faith, the heroes of the faith, things like that. And sometimes I think that we really aren't giving it a fair reading when we just look at this as, wow, look at these bigger-than-life people who are so amazing, and if I try hard enough, I'll never be like them anyway. But I'm gonna try to be a little tiny version of who they are. Oh, I would love to be one of these heroes. And the truth is, life has a way of making you feel like you're not a hero. And yet, I know all kinds of people who are totally heroes to me that wouldn't see themselves that way. But the point of Hebrews chapter 11, it's all about faith. The emphasis is not on the hall. The emphasis is on the faith. The emphasis is not on the heroes, the emphasis is on faith. And so understanding what that is, how that works, what it means, is perhaps the most critical area for us to grasp in order to walk the Christian life the way it's supposed to be lived. And I think sometimes we just don't reflect on it that much or appreciate that much how important this element of faith is. We use the term faith or faithful in essentially two senses, because and the word comes from a word that means to be persuaded or to be confident and to be dependable. And so the two uses that we tend to have of faith are, boy, that person has faith, meaning they really believe this stuff. Or the other sense is the sense of being faithful, and that is you always show up. You are consistent. You are faithful. You're dependable. You can be trusted. In reality, the two are the same thing, because continuing to hang in there takes belief. It takes conviction. When you try to hang in there without conviction, eventually you're going to let down, especially when no one's watching. And so often, a desire to be consistent without the work of God in our hearts and in our lives that really gives us this inner conviction just leads to hypocrisy. It's like, going to Sunday school every week because they're going to give a ribbon with pins on it as to how consistent you are. The kind of consistency that we're talking about that comes with faith is the kind of consistency that just simply wants to be there. And not from some great, high and mighty, super spiritual basis, but it's simply the fact that when it comes right down to it, you see that which isn't instantly visible. And that becomes ultimately, to a degree, what the definition of faith is. Faith is that which you don't see, you can't feel, it's not immediate, and yet you know it's there. So faith has to do with what comes next. Faith has to do with the future. If you lose the sense of the fact that God's not done yet, then you will lose your consistency and everything else because you dry up. And, you know, let's face it. And some of you may be in this place right now, or you were there last week, or you're going to be there this weekend. But we all go through times when it's like, this isn't worth it. This isn't gratifying. I don't feel God at all. I feel like life stinks. It throws things at me that are just totally unfair. And that's life. And in fact, life is supposed to be that way. When we understand faith, we understand that that's actually a good thing because it's what keeps us from becoming addicted to now. It's what keeps us from becoming attached to what we have. It's really a beautiful thing when you can look at your life and go, I don't even care about anything. Now that sounds like, oh, come on. But seriously, when you get to the point where there isn't anything that you are actually attached to, you become pretty flexible. Like Bob Dylan says, when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. Now, it hurts to have nothing. It really does. But it's a vital element often in discovering faith. Now, there's a way to discover faith when you have a lot. It's possible. It's just even more difficult. So Hebrews 11 starts out, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith is, again, knowing that there's more. It's knowing that God's not done. It's knowing that there's more to life than what I've presently experienced. It's understanding that my future is going to be better than my past. That's what faith is. It becomes difficult sometimes when you go through hard times, and you can start to look back like the children of Israel looked back at Egypt, and they started glamorizing the past and going, those were the good old days. A lot of times, we just forget how bad the good old days were. But faith is that ability. And notice it says, faith is the substance. We are attached to things that are substantial, things that you can feel, things that you can be presently aware of. But faith is seen here by the author of Hebrews, who I believe is Paul, is a future that is as substantial, if not more so, than anything that you've ever known and experienced thus far. And it's hope. When you really start getting down is when you start losing hope. Losing hope is a conviction that it is not going to get any better. It is just, I'm done. I give up. And maybe there are some of you that have never experienced that, but most of us have in our honest moments. We've been in those places where it's like, I hate to say it, but I am losing hope. I am losing my sense of feeling that the future might have something more, might have something better than what I've experienced so far. Well, what gives you hope is faith, is that substance that says faith is as real as my experience. And faith is as concrete as the future is. Because the future is going to happen. And God is going to be God. Faith is what you can have now that will feed your hope for the future to allow you to know that you have something to look forward to. When you stop looking forward, you're losing hope. And, you know, it gets murky when you think about, you know, there are a lot of things that you've looked forward to that didn't happen. But, and there are a lot of things that you looked forward to that did happen, and then they weren't all that great. They were unsatisfying. But the one thing that faith always does is you always have it now. Faith is not something you hope to get. Hope is not something that you hope to get. It's something that you can have tonight. God wants you to have faith and hope right now. It's not something he wants to give to you down the road. In fact, they are two of the three constants that will always be present forever. In 1 Corinthians 13, when Paul talks about, you know, that knowledge someday is going to be unnecessary and the gifts are going to be, not useful anymore. But he says love is something that's superior because it remains and it always will. But then he says, but now abide. That word means this is something that is permanent. It stays. Now abide faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. As much as God wants us to love now, he wants us to have faith now, and he wants us to have hope now. And if you are going to, you know, win the lottery next Friday, but you don't know it, you're no better off right now than you are if you're not going to win the lottery. And when we lose hope and when we lose faith, it causes us to miss out on the ultimate substance of actually what we're going to have, that future that God has for us. And so in understanding that, that's kind of what this is about. So what you will see throughout this chapter are people who had a couple of things in common. One of them, they were all sinners. Secondly, they all experienced disappointment. They all were in positions, ultimately, of feeling like, this isn't going to get better. It's always going to be like this or worse. I'm spiraling. I'm sinking. Every one of them had great reasons for believing that. And yet, when it came down to it, each of them did something that was notable that they did contrary to what they were sensing and feeling and thinking at the moment. They acted outside themselves, and they acted based on their hope and faith that there must be more than this. This can't be all there is. Now, we accept Jesus Christ. By grace are you saved through faith. It's when you came to the Lord, if you've accepted Jesus Christ, it was because you believed there's more than this. That conviction that there's more than this is what carries us through, because it's always going to be there. And I believe biblically, and we've been studying heaven in Revelation, and we're going to get into it some more this next Sunday, but I don't even think this stops when we're in heaven. I don't think that we are designed to arrive anywhere. This is a problem that we have in our culture, especially in the Western culture, is that you do what you do because you want to get somewhere. So you spend your whole life working, hoping that you'll be able to someday quit working. And you know, our school system is set up. You cram, you take tests. You cram, you take tests. And your ultimate goal is to finish school so that you never have to read another book. You never have to learn anything else. No one's ever going to test me ever again. And then once in a while you go, well, I guess I want a driver's license. Okay, I'll bone up for that test. But, you know, let's face it. Look at the people in line at the DMV. I don't think it's going to stretch you too far to pass that thing. You know, and then maybe you decide, you know, you'd like to fly an airplane. There are tests connected with that. But again, I remember when I was going for my pilot's license, I hit this spot where I thought, I don't think I can do this. And then I looked at some of the guys with pilot's licenses and I go, I can do this. But you know, everything that we do is all about a destination. But here's the thing. God hasn't created us just for a destination. And I don't even think it's correct to treat heaven like it's once you get there, you're done. Because like I pointed out last Sunday, it's in the context of heaven that God announces that he is creating constantly. I am making all things new. And we're going to see in chapter 22 of Revelation that we are going to be serving him in heaven because he doesn't ever want us to arrive. It's this life of faith and hope that gives us life. It's the process. It's the journey that is the reward. It's moving towards something. And I believe personally that for all of eternity, we will have things to look forward to. When we stop looking forward, we cease having faith. And that's a tragedy. When you do that, it's like, what are you just going to do? Wait until you die? But that's not the way we're created. Arrival isn't the point. It's always having something to look forward to. And so much of what we go through in life is set up by God to give us the opportunity to look forward to something else. I was noticing this today over in Philippians 4 where Paul's talking about contentment. And often when we think of contentment, I wonder if I can get through this tonight. Sorry, but I'll just keep going. You can leave whenever you want. But Paul talking about contentment, I've learned whatever circumstance I'm in, therewith to be content. I've learned how to be abased. I've learned how to abound. And we go, that must be nice that Paul finally got there. But what's the very next sentence he says? I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Contentment is never about being finished. Contentment is always about the empowerment that comes from going, I can do stuff. There is somebody that wants you to hang it up. There is someone that wants you to retire and to just stop. And that's the devil, because he is threatened by what we are able to do with Christ. We can do all things. And so the temptation to give up hope is the temptation that comes from the devil to tell you, you think it sucks now, wait till you see next week. And we're like, oh, boy, this is awful. And that's the voice of the enemy. God is saying, hey, I get what it's like now, but do you believe that there's something else out there? Do you believe that there is, do you think you're done? Or do you believe that you're moving forward? Do you believe that change could be actually good? And do you believe that God hasn't given up on you, but you are in this incredible process, and even while you've been hating life, you've been on a journey. You've been learning things. You've been growing. Now, if you will just latch on to hope by faith, then you can appreciate more where you are right now because you're actually in a good place. And one of the keys to life is to be honest with where you are right now and then to think, where do I go from here? So many people ruin their lives by locking into a particular preconceived notion of themselves, and then they're constantly trying to do it, and they don't know when to change their course. They don't know when to go, I guess that wasn't really the deal. I guess God must have something better for me. But a life of faith and hope is a life that's doggedly insistent on being honest about where I am today, because I believe God's hand was in bringing me to where I am. I don't think I got here because I fell off the radar of heaven. I think I am where I am for a reason. Where do I go from here? Faith says, I believe that God has great things for my future because I know God. That's just what he does. If I give up hope, I give up on him. And usually my excuse is I give up on me or I give up on other people. Well, if that's the case, then you had your faith and hope in the wrong things. You know, you go, I've lost all hope because I love the Dodgers and they're worse this year than they've ever been. My hope is gone. Well, who told you to hope in the Dodgers? You know, I love the Dodgers too. 1-4 straight. They're doing well. They're playing right now. I'd rather be there. No, I'm just kidding. I wouldn't rather be there. But it's like, what are you hoping for? And if you can put a name on or you can put a handle on what it is you're hoping for that didn't happen, then you can begin a course correction. You can begin to go, I see, I was expecting something that wasn't worthy of my hope and my faith. God doesn't let us down. The only thing that ever lets us down are things that we should have never trusted in the first place. God lovingly lets them fail so that we can find something better to hitch our wagon to, okay? So now, and in terms of the importance, well, we'll go down here. Abel is mentioned as somebody who gave a better sacrifice than Cain. And though being dead, he still speaks. It's hard to see Abel as a hero of the faith, really. We don't know much about him at all. You know, he was the second kid, you know, that was there, and he was the first murder victim. What we do know is he did one thing. He sacrificed the way God told him to. And that's good. I mean, that's not what we would consider incredible. But here's the deal. That's the only opportunity he had because his brother killed him. Now, when he was in the situation where his brother is jealous of him, his brother hates him, it's like, just imagine that you are the only two kids in the world and the other kid doesn't like you. I mean, that would be pretty miserable. That was his situation. And then all he did was the right thing, little thing, but the right thing. And he got killed for it. And yet, his example still speaks of somebody who did the right thing. You're only required to do what you are able to do. You're only required to take the opportunities that are given to you. If a little thing like this is something that would cause God to go, here's an example of faithfulness, then let's start small. What are we doing with the little tiny opportunities that God sets in front of us? And then he mentions Enoch. And these are two of the ones that are a little hard to figure out how they got in here. Because it says, by faith Enoch was taken away so that he didn't see death. And he was not found because God had taken him. For before he was taken, he had this testimony that he pleased God. All we know about Enoch, basically, is that he walked with God and he was raptured. He was taken up into heaven. We know almost nothing else. We do know about his times because it was right before the flood. We know how evil the place was. So we know how hard it would be to walk with God in a time like that. And again, people lived a long time, so it would get old. It would get tiring. It would be alienating. And all he did was walk with God, but that's all he needed to do. He probably did some other great things too, but the bottom line is, he just walked with God. You can do that. I can do that. That's not, he wasn't perfect. He just walked with God in wherever God led him. But then we get to this verse in verse 6, and this becomes critical to the whole discussion. But without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. You'll notice that him is in italics. It's not in the original. originally, the whole, you know, that may be implied or it may not, the translators thought it was. But when you think about it, without faith, you can't please anybody. Even if you're a people pleaser, you're trying to please everyone, there has to be a sense of something in the future. And so, again, here it's like, if you're going to have a connection, period, and certainly if you're going to have a connection with God, if you want to please Him, it starts with believing that He is. That's an almost preposterous notion, to believe that God is. You've never seen Him. You've never had direct contact with Him. And then beyond whether you believe there is a God, to believe that He actually rewards people who diligently seek Him is such a stretch. Because while you're struggling with, is there a God, then you have the question of, if there is a God, does He know me? Does He care what I do? If I'm looking for Him, is there a payoff somewhere? And so what he says here in this verse is that faith is what makes that happen. Now, that's just the beginning. But it's that his point is, if you can't believe in something that isn't here right now, if you can't believe in something that you can't know and experience necessarily at this moment, but and so you can't really allow yourself to look forward to something that you don't see now, then why, how can you even have a relationship with God? How can you believe in God, and especially believe in a God who cares whether or not you're looking for Him? And yet the implication is He is there. And He is who He says He is. And there is a reward for diligently seeking Him. How do you diligently seek God? Well, it certainly involves going where you haven't been before. The opposite of diligently seeking God is to give up on seeking God, or to think that you've already found Him. There are basically, you know, three or four kinds of people, categories of people in the world. There are people who are diligently seeking God. There are other people who used to diligently seek God, and now they've just become religious, and they think they already have God. They're the ones that are going around lecturing everybody else about what they need to do to, you know, if I'm going, you need to do this, this, and this, because that's what I do, and that'll make you more like me, that says, yep, I don't need to diligently seek Him anymore because I already found Him and He looks a lot like me. There are other people who just give up before they start. I don't even want to look for God. And then there are those people who are saying, you know, I'm going to stick with this. I'm going after this because every day I see glimpses of God. I sense things of His reality. I even sense Him working inside of me by His Spirit. But also, man, I see discouraging signs too. There are sometimes when I'm not so sure. But to be honest enough to say that is to say, but I'm not giving up. And that's what faith is. It's, I am not going to give up. And ultimately, these people in this chapter, what holds them together is that when it came right down to it, they didn't give up. Because they were, and it was sporadic, but when it came down to it with their lives, they decided to continue to seek after a God who they often couldn't feel, who they rarely understood, who they never saw. If you start thinking you really have a handle on God, you're probably deluded. Probably what you have a handle on is your idol of God. But diligently seeking Him is only necessary if He's elusive. And He is, because He has a different way of doing things. His ways are as high above our ways as the heavens are higher than the earth. So when you start thinking you have Him figured out, you're just plain wrong. But to commit yourself to a life of going, I am going to keep looking. I am going to keep reaching out. You'll find Him. But you'll find Him, and then you'll go, what happened, and you'll keep moving. You'll want to grow in knowing him more. You'll never get to the point of satisfaction. Now, if you think that the Christian life is all about finally getting to the point of satisfaction, then you don't understand faith, because that's not what it's about. He amazes me every day, and he disappoints me every day. But I am committed, like Peter said when Jesus asked the disciples, are you guys going to split? Where else would I go? You have the words of eternal life. The only life I've ever known came from seeking you. So whatever that life feels like at the moment, I'm not going to give up, because I just know there's no answer anywhere else. There is no other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. So let's talk about some of these guys. Abraham is the first one mentioned in this lengthier description, and it talks about how, well, in verse 8, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. Now, that's a really nice way of observing Abraham's call. If you read over in Genesis, 12, 13, 14, you realize that Abraham got called. He actually did know where he was going. God told him exactly where he was supposed to go. He found him at Ur of the Chaldees, and he goes, I want you to go on a Holy Land tour. And you're heading to the land of Canaan. I'm giving that to you. But when you read the story, and especially we learn a lot when we read Stephen's sermon in Acts as he talks about this, we find out that he didn't actually go straight where he was supposed to go. Instead of heading southwest, he headed due north. And he went to a land that was in the opposite direction than what he was supposed to go. We also read that he was supposed to leave his family. He took tons of his family with him, including his spoiled brat nephew Lot, including his dad. And ultimately, it wasn't until his dad died that he finally headed where he was supposed to go. But I love the way God records it, because those little blips don't even matter to God. Abraham, I'm sure, would look back at his life and go, that was humiliating. And God goes, what? I called you? You went there? Well, yeah, but man, I took the long way and I failed a lot along the way. Yeah, and as you see Abraham's life, you see all sorts of, any of you guys think you'd get away with telling somebody that your wife is actually your sister so they could have her and not kill you? I mean, that's a rough way to go with trying to get along with your wife. That was Abraham. I'm sure Sarah never let him forget it, but it was written in Scripture, so somehow the story got down to Moses and he wrote it down. But I mean, this guy had major failure at all kinds of points in his life. And yet when God tells a story, it's like, yeah, he obeyed. He obeyed once he had no choice. So he obeyed. That's all that matters. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise like a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Well, he did go other places and get waylaid along the way. But look at verse 10. He waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. What are you waiting for? What is it that you are looking for? What is it that you really want to see happen? Is it something that is made with hands, or is it something that cannot be made with hands? Is the drive of your life to look for something that has a real foundation, whose builder and maker is God? Do you want just what God does? Or do you just want to make up your own idea of what you're looking for? Abraham at least lived in a tent, because he knew that the city that he was looking for wasn't one that he could build or that anyone else could build. And that's a challenging question for us when we think of What do we want? What do we want out of life? What are we trying to do? But I love this. By faith, Sarah herself also, verse 11, received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. If you read the story of Sarah, it really wasn't the model of faith. She overheard the angel of the Lord, I believe it was Jesus, telling Abraham, you and Sarah are going to have a baby. And Sarah is in the tent and she hears that. I mean, give her a break. She's like 90 years old. And she's just laughing. Thought it was ridiculous. And then when Jesus came to her and goes, Sarah, what are you laughing about? I said it's going to happen. And she lies to him, goes, oh, I didn't laugh. He goes, you laughed. I heard it. So they named him. His name means laughter. So this is somebody who, you know, Hall of Faith? Really? I mean, that's seen as faith? Yes. Because ultimately, she was used by God. And when she did, I mean, she had to, at the very least, do something that she and her 100-year-old husband probably hadn't done in a while in order to have a baby. And then when the baby was born, she goes, let's name him Laughter because we got the last laugh. I laughed when I heard that I was going to be conceived, but now everybody's going to be laughing with joy to see what God has given us. So, yeah, in the overall scheme, there are a million opportunities for us to be critical, and there would be plenty of reasons for her to feel poor self-esteem about the kind of believer she was, especially later she gets to heaven and Jesus goes, oh, hey, I've met you before. And she goes, oh my goodness, you're the guy in the tent. What can I say? But as far as God's concerned, we got the job done, didn't we? You had the kid. It happened. It worked. Everything's fine. I'm not all wounded about what your failures were. And so, you know, then he goes on and it talks about, look at verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is a heavenly. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. They never actually got where they were going while they were on the earth. And you won't either. But God said, you know what? You kept moving. You kept your eyes set on the fact that this isn't going to cut it. I am not going to look for my fulfillment based on anything that I can get on this earth. There has to be something more. Faith is that expression of going, there has to be something more. And that's what causes us to not quit. Anyone who will hang in there. Now, we all check ourselves out every once in a while. Go hang ourselves on the shelf. But faith is what goes, get back in there. You're not done yet. Don't you quit on me. There's more. Life is supposed to feel this way. Life is supposed to hurt. Life is supposed to leave you wanting more because there is more. God has more for you and he's trying to create a hunger that's in you. The ladies next Monday, I think, are on the Beatitude. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they'll be filled. The very desire for something more is something that gives God an opportunity to keep us moving and to lead us forward. And so, yeah, these people never arrived, is the point. But they kept going. They didn't quit. Now, Abraham is brought up again about his sacrifice of Isaac. Now, you know, he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son. Now, I don't know if we would say a really admirable guy is a guy who, after having a son, after he also had an illegitimate son, but then he has another son, and so he's willing to sacrifice him. If somebody came to us and goes, hey, we just had our first kid, even if they weren't 100 years old, and they go, you know, but I think God's telling me to go sacrifice the kid, what would you do? I mean, this was absolutely crazy. Except this one time, this was something that God wanted to do. And of course, he didn't want him to sacrifice his son. He wanted him to be willing to. So what are you willing to let go of? See, Abraham hung in there until he was 100. In those days, they would start having kids in their teens. And he's been, you know, just humiliated by not being able to produce offspring for all those years. And then he's 99 years old and God tells him it's going to happen. Well, hey, by that time, it's like you could worship Isaac. I mean, you know people who struggle to have a kid for a long time and they can't and then they finally do. They usually spoil the kid rotten because it's like, oh, this, I'm going to cling to this kid. And that would be natural. Because we are oriented toward arriving. All I want is a kid. Yeah, wait till you see what he's like when he grows up. Wait till you see how he is capable of hurting you. Wait till you see, oh, we don't even think to that. It's just, I got a kid. Abraham had at least 80 years of wanting a kid, and he got him. And God wanted to go, now are you willing to let go of him? Are you willing to release him to me? And we all have that question, that test constantly. You get something that you really want and you appreciate it and God goes, will you let go of it? Your dream house, the car that you love, the person that you always wanted to marry, children, a job, whatever it is, it's like, oh, God, thank you. And he goes, mind if I take it away? What? Because I want you to keep moving. You're only visiting this place. You're a pilgrim. You're a sojourner. I got to keep you plodding away. And so, yeah, I'll bless you to let you know how I feel about you. But sometimes I'll take away what I've given. Sometimes I make you believe something good is going to happen so that you'll get up in the morning. And then when I think you're ready, I'll go, nope, it's not that. It's something better. And we're like, what? That's what keeps us moving. And that's what faith is ultimately, is the ability to, every time we're disappointed, to go, let's get back at this. Let's go work on this again. It's like a sports team that just is so pumped. And they're, maybe they have, a football team is in the Super Bowl. And they've dreamed, all these kids have dreamed of this their whole lives. And now they're pumped, they're ready, they're prepared. They play their hearts out. Somebody gets a lucky play, a bad official call or whatever, and they lose the Super Bowl. And a real champion goes, tomorrow we start preparing for next year. That's what you do. That was the kind of thing that Abraham was willing to do with Isaac. And it's why it's used as an example. He goes on and talks about Isaac as being a man of faith by blessing Jacob and Esau. Of course, when you read the story, he blessed them by being deceived by Jacob. And then he talks about, you know, Jacob being this man of faith when he was dying. Jacob was a guy who not only conned his dad, conned his brother. He ended up at one point just being almost hopeless because he got run out of town because his brother hated him. And he goes and lives with his uncle, who's a con man. And his uncle's ripping him off and, you know, cheating him out of years of work and his wife and everything else. If anybody ever felt like, I'm just going to hang it up, it would be him. But he had that moment when he was a little jerk his whole life. And then he has that moment where before he goes back home, he's alone with God. And he lays down and he puts his head on a rock for a pillow and he sees this vision and all of a sudden it's like, what's happening? He wrestles with Jesus, and he gets crippled for life, and as he limps away, the Lord says to him, you prevailed. You won by losing. You won because you wouldn't quit. You insisted on a blessing. And then he's named Israel instead of Jacob, and he becomes the father of a whole nation. But I guarantee you, at that time when he thought his brother was going to kill him, and maybe even while he was in the middle of the wrestling match, faith wasn't necessarily his first thought. But the guy didn't quit. He didn't stop fighting. And as a result, God looked at him and goes, all those years of messing up, they don't even matter. Because when it came down to it, we got our stuff together and you believed and you kept moving. And, you know, you go on, Moses, it says by faith Moses when he was born, so it's really not Moses, it's really his parents. They hid him in a basket and floated him out into the river. Not the greatest example of faith, but somehow they believed something would work out. And sometimes that's the best you can do, to just go, this is, I have a bunch of choices, they all look bad, I'm going to make the best choice I can think of, and I'm going to believe that somehow it's going to work out. Faith. Believing that the future holds things that I don't see right now and I don't know. And it was amazing. And think about it. Then his mom got to raise him and was supported by the government in doing so. But then as it goes on and talks about Moses, how, you know, boy, he left Egypt and he hung in there and then he delivered the children of Israel and everything. Well, hey, Moses spent 40 years just living in Egypt doing nothing. He spent the next 40 years living in the desert because he was afraid to go back to Egypt. He was 80 before he ever even started any kind of ministry at all. And then he didn't want to do it. He's like fighting with God. I don't want to do it. But ultimately became maybe the greatest leader in the history of that nation because he was pushed and forced and prodded and bugged. And finally he goes, okay, God says, let my people go. And he led them out. And he led them through the wilderness, and he led them right to the border of the promised land. Got him through 40 years of education in the process. He's finally 120 years old. Never got to see the promised land until the Gospels, when he shows up on the Mount of Transfiguration. So what kind of an example is he of faith? The perfect kind of example. Because faith is not about arriving. Moses didn't arrive. But Moses didn't quit. Faith is not about perfection. If you're perfect, you wouldn't need faith. If you had everything you want, if you were a pinnacle of everything that everyone should be, you're a paragon of virtue, what do you need faith for? But Moses understood his frailty, and in his brokenheartedness, in his disappointment, in his shame, in his humility, the one thing he had was faith, because he always believed that better days were coming. He always believed that it's not all about just this right now. And because of it, he's an example of faith. Now, we don't have time to go into all these other people. The walls falling down because of Joshua believing God and marched around and caved in Jericho. Rahab lying to hide, the spies from Israel and then her and her family being saved. Again, kind of weird to think of a prostitute as being, here's an example of faith. Oh, what did the prostitute do to make herself so great? She lied. Nice. But she somehow believed she wasn't done yet. And I don't believe that ended the story for her. We just don't know a lot about how. But don't you believe she went on and goes like, you know what? When you're known for all of eternity as a lying prostitute, I got nothing to lose. And so here she is as an example of faith. And then he mentions just Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah in verse 32, David, Samuel, all the other prophets. And you know, and these guys are funny. They only get devoted basically a few words to him. But Gideon's a guy who, yeah, won a battle by honking a trumpet and breaking a lantern. But when God called him, he was afraid. He didn't want to do it. God had to keep doing magic tricks for him so he would finally do what God told him to do. But he finally did it, you know. And then Samson, I mean, come on. Samson was a guy who's just constantly failing morally, using the strength that God had given him just to do childish stunts. He was a guy who was into himself, very proud, powerful, yeah, but he never lived up to his potential. How did he get in here? Well, just for mainly one event. And at the end of his life, after feeling like such a failure, he had been, because of his own foolishness, he was now blinded, he was weakened, he was a joke to the Philistines. They used him for their entertainment, and yet one day, a guy who really never believed anything except in himself, one day he decided, okay, God, can you do this one more time? Can you give me strength right now and so that I can push this house down and it'll collapse on this Philistine party, and God, I'd appreciate it. My eyes, they took my eyes, so avenge my eyes and by your power destroy these Philistines. And he had his greatest moment, which involved his death. And sometimes faith involves death. Several of these people ended up dying for believing in the future. But he did it. And so God doesn't see his life and goes, you know what? On the whole, he was a dirtbag. He was a loser. And yeah, big deal. He had one big moment. But how do you balance one big moment off against all this failure? All of these, you know, lies, all the betrayal, all the egotism and selfishness, all of the moral corruptness and all the prostitutes and everything else. How in the world can you see him as somebody who's a great man of faith? Well, he never says great man of faith. We're the ones that make that up. He's just an example of a guy who at some point decided that there's a future. Decided that God isn't finished with me yet. And he easily could have come to the conclusion that God was finished with him, and it felt like that. His eyes were gone, his strength's gone, his hair is gone. But somehow, in the middle of all that, he had nothing to lose. Didn't care if he lived or died. And so he, for that moment, decided something good can happen. God could use me to do what I've been supposed to do my whole life, and I haven't really done it. None of us have even come close to failing the magnitude that he failed. God isn't done with you. God isn't done with any of us. Because faith means, no, we can move on. We can move forward. We're not done. The future is real. The hope, that knowledge that God knows what he's doing, it's there for us. It's just, we should be able to just taste it just because we know God. And so even if it's just that one moment, as far as God's concerned, you did what mattered. You finally listened. And God didn't look at Samson and go, what a shame. Because I gave you opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. I gave you gifts. I gave you talents. I, you know, you had every chance to be a great leader over Israel. And you never delivered until you were ready to die. God doesn't do that. God sees him fail morally repeatedly. And he's like, I'm not done. He sees him foolishly, you know, arrogantly, just, you know, carrying city walls just to show off. And God's like tapping his foot. I'm not done. God sees him, you know, in all the foolish things that he did, ultimately being disgraced and humiliated, and God started going, I think we're getting somewhere now. And after him languishing in prison for a while and then being humiliated enough to where there was finally nothing left and he had nothing to lose, then that moment of strength that destroyed the Philistines and delivered Israel, and God goes, way to go, Samson. Now we're talking. That's exactly what I've been talking about. That's what I've been wanting you to do. I'm not going to lecture you about all the times you didn't do it. You did it, and I'm writing your name down so that everyone will always know that I am not finished with anyone. And, I mean, some of these other guys, Jephthah is mentioned. He's a guy who's mostly famous for the fact that one time he goes, God, I love you so much, I'll sacrifice whatever walks in the door. And his daughter walked in the door. Barak was a guy who will be known forever as the guy who was afraid to go to war unless a woman, Deborah, would go with him. But you know what? He went to war. He finally did it. He did what he was supposed to do. And then all of these descriptions, you know, they subdued kingdoms, they worked righteousness, they obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, and so on. People were raised from the dead and all this kind of stuff. And in verse 38, of whom this world was not worthy, but, he says, verse 39, and all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. He goes, none of them finished while they were here. And as a result, do you think we should expect to finish while we're here? Do you think you're done? Do you think it's kind of like, yeah, my best days are ahead of me. I'm pretty much over. I'm just sort of waiting for the rapture to come. And hey, God's not finished with you, because that's not what he does. He always gives a promise. He always gives hope. He always gives faith. And those things necessitate the awareness that you aren't there yet, that he isn't done, that you're on a journey, that we're on a path together. Now, as we get into chapter 12, shortly, he says, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, all these people who never arrived but who had that faith, they carried it with them. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. There's the point. We have a choice. Are we going to become weary and discouraged in our souls? Or are we going to look at Jesus and say, I have a race to run. And there are things that are weighing me down. There are sins that are entangling me and tripping me up. And for me to have hope and for me to have faith, I have to let go of that stuff. Now, a lot of times when people teach on this, and I've probably done it myself, the emphasis is on you need to, the weight and the sin are like, there are some things that you do that aren't specifically a sin, but they're kind of unnecessary. They get in your way. And the sin is obviously you need to stop sinning so that you can run an effective race. But as I look at it in the context of everything that he's saying, I'm not so sure that that's what he's saying, or at least that that's all that he's saying. What is it that causes people to become weary and discouraged? It's usually not that they're busy sinning. It's usually that they're laboring over sins that they've already committed. It's that, you know, when we fail, God's not surprised, but we're shocked. Every time I do something wrong, I mean, I very foolishly think, how in the world could I have ever done that? How did I say that? Why did I think that? Why did I go there? Why did I treat this person that way? I spend an awful lot of my time feeling like a failure. And it doesn't cause me to sin more most of the time. It just causes me to just not do anything. It causes me to feel like quitting. It makes me just feel like I will never be what I want to be. I'll never please God. God isn't pleased by what you do. God is pleased by your faith. God is pleased because you haven't quit. And I'm convinced that a lot of what he's talking about here that holds us back is our own awareness of our own sin. That when we are convicted of sin, we confess our sin, and he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness, we just don't believe that. We don't believe that we've been forgiven. And so we lug those sins with us. And sometimes we think, well, at least it'll come in handy if I ever share my testimony, because, boy, I can remember how many bad things I did. And there are some people who even think, you know, I better go do some bad stuff so I have a testimony. But that's not it at all. Do you understand that God, just like anyone who wants you to run a race, they want you to be as light as you possibly can? Now, you look back years ago, and remember some of us who are around my age, remember what our PE uniforms were like? They weighed like 10 pounds. They were just so hanging on us, and then you sweat, and you felt, you know, awful as you did it. And the sports uniforms get lighter and lighter and easier to wear. You look at the old NBA games where they had those little short, you know, shorts that look like a, you know, some guy in a gay bar or something. And it, you know, now they wear the long baggy shorts because they found out, actually, I'm a lot freer when I'm wearing, you know, something that's loose, but they're very light. Athletic shoes, back in the day, really heavy, no support. Athletic shoes today, light, sleek, supportive. Technology continues to improve. Now when people run, when they swim, they're wearing different things than they used to wear. And it's all about how can I run the best race that I can. And so that which drags us down is that which chains us up. And because the devil can read and he knows that he is going to spend his eternity in chains, all of his effort toward Christians is to try to put us in chains now. He can't take our salvation away from us. He can take away the joy of our salvation, which, you know, does the same kind of damage right now. That's why David in Psalm 51 said, "Restore unto me the joy of your salvation." The joy goes easily as soon as I feel trapped, as soon as I feel like I am carrying my sin. And I'll tell you something, most of the time when you're lugging those burdens, it's not because you decided to do that. Maybe some people are moral enough that they can pile it on themselves. Usually somebody else piled it on you. Sometimes somebody you think's really godly, or sometimes it's a pastor who, like, in their mind, they think they're speaking out for righteousness, but really what they're doing is just making you feel like you'll never succeed because you have that sin that you will always carry with you. And Jesus goes, excuse me, I carried that with me to the cross. It's gone. It's history. The only way that we can live by faith, the only way that we can run a good race is if we strip down of everything extra. Take off the sweats, take off the jewelry, take off the backpack. Don't bring your lunch with you. You got a race to run. The only way we can do that and not quit is when by faith we say, I am going to believe what God says about my sin. And I'm not going to let my sin weigh me down anymore because he took it on himself. So no more am I going to take myself out because of sin. I'm going to lay it aside. And I'm also going to find anything else that's weighing me down. Now, that might be distractions. That could be angry birds. It could be all sorts of things that are just like, this is eating up my day. This is destroying my life. And the reminder from Hebrews here is that, you know what? The name of the game is that you not become weary and discouraged in your soul, in your psyche, in who you really are. And that's what these examples are all about. Because every one of them at one time or another was discouraged and weary. Some of them about to give up and check out. But every one of them from God's perspective ultimately got back up and they went for it. When they finally got to the point, many of them, where they had nothing to lose, they figure, man, my story is already so bad that now it doesn't matter anymore. And they got on with living their lives. Faith and hope is what was set before them. I don't know your situation, what you're laboring with right now, but I'm certain that there are many of us in here who are losing hope and losing faith because we just think, it's been so bad, the failure is so great, my percentages are so off, I'm like 0 for 500, and now when I walk up to the plate, I'm not even expecting to get a hit. Now when I'm walking to the free throw line, I don't think that ball's going in. I can't do it. I give up. There's nothing more tragic than when you see a player on a sporting team who asks the coach to take them out of the game. It's horrible. It's so sad. Or when people just decide, I've failed enough, I quit. But a million times more tragic than that is when people who were bought and paid for by the blood of Jesus Christ, who God gifts and places within the body and says, I love you, I have a plan for you, I have a future for you, and we go, sorry, God, I don't have the courage. I am discouraged. Something happened that has caused me to give up. The only way you lose in life, in the Christian life, is if you give up. Satan knows that, and so he'll do whatever he can to make you give up. But faith, that's that thing, that substance, and it is, it's substantial. When you begin to believe in the future, you can feel it. Even now, you know how if you just decide, tomorrow I am going to go and apply for this job, and you've been so discouraged you haven't applied for a job for a while, you already feel better just by saying you're going to do it. Now you need to do it, because tomorrow you're going to need faith to get you to the future. But if you give up, nothing good will ever happen. Nothing ever good will come of that. It's like these tragic people who, they make millions of dollars as an athlete, and they're 25 years old, and they're washed up, and the rest of their life, they're doing nothing with their life. They just think, I had my moment, I had my day in the sun, and I quit. Don't be that guy. Don't be that girl. Don't be the one who ever decides, my courage is gone, my strength isn't here anymore. Tomorrow is going to be worse than today. I know it, so I better just curl up in a fetal position and be prepared for the worst. Prepare for the best, because we serve a God who loves to surprise us. And I'm telling you this right now, just because I don't know what you're going through, but I know God. And there are some people in here right now who feel like, all I see in the future is just black. It's bleak. It's dark. And God has your absolute best days that are ahead of you. And if you can grab onto that faith, if you can just go, you know what, God, you are telling the truth. I saw it in your word tonight, and I'm going to believe it. There is a tomorrow. There is a future. There is a reason for hope. I do want faith now. And to grab onto that is to do that which defines the essence of what it is to walk with God. That's what the Christian life is supposed to feel like. When you give up, and a lot of times we give up because we're just shooting for the wrong things. I love that quote from Howard Hendricks. I've quoted him several times on this, but he said, you know, when you get to the point where your memories are more exciting than your dreams, then you've started to die. When we start living our life thinking about what we've lost rather than excited about what the future holds, we're kind of hanging it up. Now, that gets tougher the older you get because, you know, to convince yourself that the future is better when it's definitely shorter is, you know, that's a challenge. But come on, you've been alive. You've seen how God has come through for you. You've seen how he has worked. You've seen how things can turn on a dime. He's not any different now. And he doesn't expect you to arrive until you get to heaven. And I believe when we get to heaven, he's going to go, good to see you. Well done. Now let's get busy. We have places to go and people to see. I don't ever want to be done. Oh, there are times when I feel like it. There are times when I want to give up. Man, I'm telling you, if you probably knew how many times I felt that, you'd go find a healthier pastor. But I know, like Job said, I know that my Redeemer lives. I know that he is working. I know he's here. And I will hang on to that. And if I have nothing but faith, faith is what I want to have clutching in my hands right down to the last moment. I want to, on the final day of my life, I want to be looking forward to next week. I want to die that way. That's the way these guys died. Not having got where they were going, but always looking forward to where they were going to go. And ultimately, as we study heaven, we realize we're never going to stop going. So let's keep on the move now. Don't check out. Don't give up. Don't let discouragement rob you of the excitement, not just the excitement of next week. And it can, you know, because if you get really negative, it becomes self-fulfilling. You can ruin next week by just nobody wanting to be around you. But the excitement about next week happens now. Faith is about the future, but faith is substantial now. And so today, grab onto that faith and appreciate it and enjoy it. Live in it. Future will take care of itself. Sorry for keeping you late, but I was just looking forward to finishing this message. So let's pray. God, thank you for your word. And Lord, you know, it's not a game to think, oh, maybe somebody here needs to hear this. We all need to hear this. It's the core of who you want us to be and how you want us to live. And we do want to please you. Help us to grab faith now. Help us to live hopeful now because we know the kind of God that we serve. Help us to never give up on the future because giving up on the future is giving up on you. Thank you for these examples from the Old Testament. You're so honest about these people that we can use our imagination and think that a lot of them are way worse than we ever were. But they didn't give up. So we won't either. In Jesus' name, amen.